Welcome to Switzerland in Sound, produced and presented by Bob Zanotti.
Welcome to Switzerland in Sound. This is Bob Zanotti. I'm sitting across a table at my home in the Emmental, not too far from the Swiss federal capital, Bern. And I'm going to tinkle glasses with this fella. Cheers, Peter.
Cheers, Bob.
I'm talking to Peter Haller, H-A-L-L-E-R, who is an old friend and former colleague when we used to work for the International Radio together. You were the parliamentary correspondent, the correspondent for the International Radio, the English service, for 15 years. You are Swiss, but you grew up in London. So, in other words, you have an international view of Switzerland. I'm saying all of this because that's very much what our discussion is about. Let's look back to the founding of Switzerland, apparently and allegedly, according to the story, on the 1st of August, 1291. What happened?
In 1291, three cantons, Uri, Schwyz and Unterwalden, came together to form what is called the Everlasting Alliance, which is the basis of today's country as well. It was basically a collection of Swiss farmers or peasants who were protesting against Austrian Habsburg hegemony, and the Everlasting Alliance was basically a defense alliance designed to give the Swiss some rights against their Austrian overlords.
It sounds a lot like the American Declaration of Independence.
Yes, it wasn't anything as sophisticated as that or as long as that, but it certainly formed the nucleus, which then grew to 13 or 14 or 15 other cantons later, and this was still basically a defense alliance till the Napoleonic invasion at the beginning of the 19th century, which, if you like, gave the first political impetus to what later became Switzerland. And you could really say that Switzerland as a political entity was founded in 1848 with the first constitution, the first degree of centralism.
Now, we'll get back to 1848 in a few moments, but let's stay in the distant past. This was the age of William Tell, wasn't it? The legendary Swiss hero.
William Tell was one of the, as the myth has it, was one of the founding fathers of the three original cantons, the Everlasting Alliance. What nowadays one tends to think that perhaps there wasn't one William Tell, but that he is really an amalgam of similar figures.
And again, the American Declaration of Independence. We've had enough of Mother England exploitation being pushed around, and we're saying we're not taking it anymore. This is what the early Swiss founding fathers were saying too.
Yes, it was oppression by the Habsburg or Austrian
and taxation.
And taxation, overlords, and basically the first demand of the Everlasting Alliance was to have their own laws, to have their own jurisdiction. They didn't want jurisdiction from foreign masters, and that is in fact something which is true even of today's Switzerland, one of the reasons why Switzerland is not a member of the European community.
And also permanently neutral. This is another interesting aspect that we'll get into. Well, let's approach the year 1848, the first significant Swiss constitution since the Pact of Everlasting Alliance. Can you bring us up to date between 1291 and 1848? What happened? What were the stages of maturity and evolution that took place in the Swiss political system?
Yes, you could say this was a loose alliance of states who basically had as the lowest common denominator the desire to be independent of foreign masters. So therefore, defense was, if you like, the major form of their alliance. And this kept growing till the 16th century. And this was followed by a period of expansionism, because once these states or cantons got together, they discovered they had a certain strength of their own, a sort of self-momentum, which meant that they became a threat to the foreign masters who of course now are the big states of Europe around them. And Switzerland in fact started pursuing what was then called Switzerland was a loose alliance of states or cantons, and they became more expansionist and started invading neighboring territories, started annoying the big masters of Europe.
And the Swiss were not always peaceful and docile people.
No, on the contrary, I think what happened was once they realized that forming alliances amongst themselves gave them a certain strength and power of their own, they started exploiting this power and invading neighboring areas, much to the annoyance of the French and the Italians. The Germans didn't exist then, but the Austrians did. And if you like, this culminated in the Battle of Marignano in the
northern Italy near Milan.
The 16th century, and it was basically the last Swiss military attempt to expand because they got very heavily drubbed by the big states of Europe around them.
This was the beginning of neutrality, wasn't it?
Yes, you could really say after the Battle of Marignano there was de facto neutrality, and Switzerland stopped being expansive. And politically speaking, neutrality goes back to the Congress of Vienna in 1815 after the Napoleonic Wars, when Swiss neutrality was actually underwritten by the big powers. It became an obligation, in fact, as well for Switzerland.
Yeah, this is something which is, I think, extremely important to point out. We have to remember that Swiss neutrality goes back centuries and was officially established and recognized and guaranteed by Europe as a whole. This is not something that just popped up one day for a matter of convenience.
Yes, one can say that after the Battle of Marignano in the 16th century, it took over two centuries for the neutrality to be formally recognized, but it was basically imbued in the Swiss spirit because the Swiss had had an expansive period of warfare, and they realized that that wasn't a very productive form of living together.
Yeah, there are better things to do.
Yes, quite.
Yeah. Now, we go to the Constitution of 1848. That was a major political statement. What basically was the revolution that was contained in that document of 1848? What was special about it?
Well, you have to see that in the year before, in 1847, there was actually a brief civil war in Switzerland, basically between the conservative Catholic farming cantons, which in fact formed the nucleus of Switzerland, and the more modern urban liberal cantons outside, like Zurich, for instance, the industrial cities.
This is the so-called Sonderbund War, which is really a civil war based on religion, in effect. Catholic versus Protestant.
Yes, certainly.
Mine's one of Northern Ireland.
Yes, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's more or less a taboo subject today. But certainly it was a war between Catholics and Protestants, between urban and agricultural populations, between liberals and conservatives. Mm. And the result was a typical Swiss compromise. And the first Swiss constitution of 1848, which leaned very heavily on the American constitution, gave Switzerland the face of a united nation, which it was, bringing together various ethnic and language groups, town and country, but also guaranteeing basic rights to each individual citizen, and also incorporating a level of centralism in the sense that a central body or a central state was given the power of defense, the power of foreign policy, for instance.
You used the word compromise a moment ago, and I know it's almost folklore in Switzerland. People talk about compromise as a virtue in this country, and that even at the national level, at all levels of politics, there is this almost religion of compromise.
Yes, it's the basic prerequisite to bring together three national languages, or four if you want to be totally precise, to bring together two major religious blocks, to bring together different ethnic groups. The only way you can get those all under one lid is by having a compromise, and the Swiss way to do this is to have a totally federal system. There is a degree of centralism, but basically local and regional autonomy is written very large, and the concomitant of this federalism is also what is known as subsidiarity, which is one of the catchwords of the European Union. It basically means that every decision is taken at as low a possible political level as possible. Mm-hmm. In other words, the central government doesn't deal with things like street lighting. It deals with things like defense and national taxation and policy, foreign policy. But all other decisions are devolved onto the cantons or states, and even onto the local communes or communities.
Enter a very important, a key word here, and that is decentralization. Switzerland is anything but centralistic. We think of some classic centralistic governments like the French, like the Italian, for example. This country is based on an entirely different philosophy. In fact, it's an inverted pyramid.
You could really, if you take the American example of a president and Congress and the people, in Switzerland you have those three elements as well. You have a cabinet, you have a parliament, you have the people. But basically, the powers associated with a presidency or with a parliament are turned upside down in Switzerland, because the Swiss population or Swiss voters can overturn practically every decision taken by the cabinet and or parliament.
Which is one of the reasons why, let's say at federal level or cantonal level, which is very important, state and national politics, politicians tend to be more realistic. They don't come with, let's call them crazy ideas or extremist ideas, because they know eventually they're going to have to be, or could very well be, decided by the public. And if they're not realistic to start with, they don't have a chance.
Yes, that is why you also have another peculiarity of the Swiss political system, is that every law, every draft law, can only be drawn up after a very extensive consultation procedure. For instance, if you want a building law or a law on town and country planning, you have to consult not only the cantons and the local communes, you have to consult the building industry, you have to consult the trade unions relating to the building industry.
Anybody who might be affected.
Any interested party has to be consulted. And if you like, the draft law that comes out of this consultation, which takes up to 3 months and many hundred letters, the draft law that comes out of this is basically already balanced out to give it the maximum chance of getting parliamentary approval, and even that is not enough, because if parliament approves it, the people can still turn it down. So you could either say it's a totally wishy-washy system, or it is a totally balanced system.
Well, this is an extremely interesting point. From the point of view of spectacular fireworks politics, the Swiss system is extremely dull. When you look at the polemics that go on in the parliaments of other countries. But at the end of the day, the laws that are passed have a higher acceptance level and have a better chance of passage simply because they have been checked beforehand with all those considered. So the polemics are by nature reduced from the word go.
Yes, you could say it's a totally cumbersome system, but once a compromise has been reached, you can be pretty sure that it will be accepted by 70 to 90% of the people, which means that compliance with that law afterwards is also likely to be high.
I have heard an old rule of thumb in Swiss politics that unless you have about 80% acceptance for any concept or idea or law on the part of the general public, there's no point in even trying the law, because less than 80% compliance is not going to work.
Yes, you see that quite often that, for instance, as an example, one of the many democratic rights which Swiss have is the right to amend or to supplement the Constitution. 100,000 Swiss citizens can sign an amendment or a supplement of the Constitution, and after 18 months it has to come before a national referendum. In that period of time, the government can issue a counter-proposal, which is very often the case, but basically an initiative or amendment to the Constitution only has a 25 or 30% chance of success, so the government has a chance to water down the proposal while still leaving just a little bit of sap in the tree. But ultimately what will happen is that the nudge given by the initiative or by the people will be diluted to be accepted by 60, 70, 80% of the population.
It's been said, not by us, but it's been said by others, and I think we could agree, that Switzerland today in the modern world is about the only true democracy, in the sense that the people have the final say on everything. But we talked before, quite a while ago already, about the founding fathers of Switzerland, but they also interacted with the founding fathers, for example, of the United States, and notions of people's initiatives, direct democracy, which are now familiar to Americans, North Americans. These are direct Swiss concepts that were taken over.
They are, in fact, American and Swiss concepts. There was a sort of a reaction and action between the two. And, for instance, I think certain states of the Union, like California, you can also demand a referendum on certain subjects there. Even in Italy, you have a right of referendum on certain laws. And interesting enough, even the European Union feels obliged to hold referenda or to demand referenda on certain issues. I mean, to say who invented it, I don't know. It's obviously the Greeks invented it. But certainly, I think there was, between the American Founding Fathers and the Swiss Constitution, there was a sort of give and take, a sort of a cross-fertilization, if you like.
Something else which is very typically Swiss, the town meetings, where major issues, I mean, at least on the local level, are decided every few months. There's a town meeting, they get together, and people are confronted with particular issues that are voted on by show of hands or by some other ballot. This is, of course, very typically Swiss. This is something also known in many states in the United States.
Yes, I mean, basically, you as well as the federal parliament, you have 26 cantons and half cantons, or states, who all have their own parliaments and governments or executives, but you also have almost 3,000 local communities, which can be a matter of 200 people or 5,000 people, and of these 3,000, 20% still have parliaments. And even if they don't have a parliament, you can still have the local assembly. Show of hands is now more or less phasing out. But
it still exists here in the Emmental, though.
It certainly exists still. But certainly voting on any kind of local issue is the norm, yes.
Mm-hmm. But the important issue is that the individual citizen has the final say, and they are the ones who are consulted. It's not simply a show. It's not a pro forma procedure. It is the citizen who literally has the final say.
Yes, I mean, there are endless examples. I remember going back almost 20 years, the government introduced a law saying that seat belts should be compulsory in motor vehicles. And basically not all that many people were against it. But somebody noticed that the law wasn't totally correctly legalistically phrased and called a referendum. And ultimately, the seatbelt issue was passed because it's a sensible issue.
But by public vote.
By public vote. But the government had to rephrase and redraft the law and take it through Parliament again.
And the Swiss citizen or groups of citizens, through the referendum, can initiate legislation, can call for a vote on almost anything, any proposition. Even speed limits on the roads are decided by referendum.
Well, I mean, basically, any Swiss law passed by Parliament, if you get 50,000 signatures, you can call a referendum against it, and a nationwide vote has to be held on this law.
Peter Holler, we talked about neutrality as something that emerged centuries ago out of the age of Swiss adventurism and expansionism, which ended in the 16th century. But Swiss neutrality exists today. It is not the sacred cow that it used to be, especially since the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall. And neutrality simply meant, up until that point, we don't get involved in anybody else's wars or problems. That was a fairly straightforward and universally accepted concept. But now it's getting more difficult. The Berlin Wall is down, the Cold War is down, we have the European Union, which is now expanded to 25 countries. It's getting more and more difficult for many Swiss to justify neutrality.
Yes, I mean, basically you could say that, for instance, in the Second World War, armed neutrality meant that Switzerland would not take sides unless attacked. Basically, you remain neutral till you're attacked. Then after that, you're free.
Let's face it, even during the Cold War period, Switzerland was a de facto member of NATO. This was an open secret.
Switzerland was a member of a northwestern hemisphere.
Yeah. And among the best defended militarily, the best armed nations in Europe. I mean, yet the equal of any NATO country.
Yes, one could really say that the privilege of having your neutrality underwritten by the other nations was that you didn't leave a defense vacuum on their flanks. And that's why Switzerland's national defense has always been effective and serious, has to be taken seriously. And that, if you like, is the price you pay for having your neutrality respected by other countries. You become not a threat, but you certainly become an expensive stone or hurdle in the way of any invasion?
Well, this is a very hot issue because in the last few years we've heard this very controversial issue about why did the Germans not invade Switzerland? And of course the romantic notion is that because the Swiss army was so prepared, they would have inflicted so many losses on the Germans that it was not really worth it to conquer this country. The more cynical observers say it's because Switzerland was playing the banker to Hitler. Now, somewhere in between must lie the real truth.
Well, I mean, basically, when you have to import all your fuel, all your metal and raw materials from the warring nations, be they the Allies.
A country with no, nota bene, no natural resources.
Except water and a bit of salt, yes.
And some intelligence.
Yes. So basically, you really had to play both ends against the middle to survive. But of course, I would say that the fact that you survive is also, you don't leave a vacuum. And for instance, what I would say to Americans or English who don't like neutrality, just imagine if Switzerland had been occupied by the Nazis, what a terrible loss of life there would have been if they had to, for instance, reoccupy Switzerland and dislodge the Germans. I mean, that would have been worse than the Battle of the Bulge.
And don't forget, just to continue on your thought, Switzerland is a country with natural fortifications. The Alps are really something immense. They are to be reckoned with, and it would have required a great deal of manpower and effort to, as you say, reoccupy this country. Let's look at relations finally, Peter Holler, between Switzerland and the European Union. One has the impression that things do happen at a snail's pace here. Some people are still in the age of the Cold War. They don't realize the wall is down in Berlin. The things have changed enormously. The war is over, so to speak. That's maybe one view. The other view is, let's go into it. Let's become part of Europe. Let's go for full membership in the European Union. And somewhere in the middle, you have a lot of Swiss who are saying, Switzerland is a special case. We should be teaching the European Union, not the other way around. Can you sort this out for us? Where, in your estimation, is the mentality of the man in the street Swiss right now in terms of relations with the European community and possible membership?
It's official Swiss government policy, and has been since 1991, to sooner or later join the EU. Before the Swiss government could do this, they would have to hold a plebiscite. For the last 15 years, you could say that this plebiscite would probably fall between 49 and 51% pro or contra. In other words, the government, under no circumstances, can risk a national vote, which it's likely to lose. So, therefore, the question isn't even posed, because even today, there are some surprising alliances. For instance, the majority of Swiss industry, certainly the Confederation of Swiss Industry, is not for a EU membership, because they say Switzerland's interests are global interests, Swiss trade is universal and not European, and that ultimately Switzerland has more interest in securing its international global trade rather than having a short-term interest in trade only with Europe. In other words, you could say that the Swiss population is not yet ready to join the EU simply because it doesn't have to.
But the cynic would come in and say, or the critic even, and say, look, a typical case of the Swiss wanting it both ways. You have to make up your mind. You can't have the cake and eat it too.
Well, then the Swiss would say the only reason why the EU wants Switzerland is because it would be the last net payer into the EU coffers. It would be the last net contributor. It would cost Switzerland probably 1 to 2 billion francs annually to become a member of the EU.
Which the government is prepared to do. It has the money available and is prepared to pay it.
It's prepared to pay it because it thinks the long-term gains would be greater. I think most Swiss would say that ultimately, if the EU continues, and let's face it, 25 nations keeping them together, who knows? I mean, the Soviet Union didn't last forever either. There's certain skepticism about the durability of the present enlarged EU, and at the moment there is no economic or political compulsion to join. However, one also has to see that Switzerland is pursuing what is called the bilateral route. In other words, there are bilateral agreements between the European Union and Switzerland. The latest 9 agreements are due to be signed in the near future. But the real question is, how long will the enlarged EU tolerate a little country standing out of line?
And hitching a free ride. That's the way it's seen by many EU members.
Well, the EU, of course, if it sees it that way, it's not quite right. Because, I mean, for instance, Switzerland is prepared to pay into the EU Cohesion Fund to help the Eastern European nations, the new members, even though it's not a member of the EU. And in fact, Swiss Development Aid has been very active supporting the Eastern European countries before they joined the EU. So, I mean, I think that's the one-sided view. But certainly many Swiss think that paying into the EU coffers just to help certain southern European member countries, as it's usually put, it's not very popular.
But in effect, even today as we speak, without a deep and further or dramatic further involvement, Switzerland is in effect, in practical ways, a member of the EU in terms of the harmonization of tariffs, the harmonization of practices, rules, regulations, ways of doing business and comportment. It really, in effect, is a member, a de facto member of the EU.
People forget that in 1972, a totally, absolutely vital agreement was reached with the EU, the Free Trade Agreement with the EU. And as you say, since 1972, you could say that Swiss trade and customs regulations and tariffs have been more or less in line, barring, for instance, agriculture, with the EU. So in other words, Swiss industry hasn't at all been handicapped in its exports. You could say in trade terms, Switzerland is a member of the EU, and I could just quote Mr. de la Miro, a late cabinet minister who died a couple of years ago, who said, if we keep our laws in line with the EU, then we won't have to join.
Which is proving to be correct. Peter Holler, you were a parliamentary correspondent for the International Swiss Radio for 15 years. You have your own views. You've given a professional, neutral account, an objective account of the issues as I've asked you to comment on them. But what is your own feeling? How do you see this country going? Where does it stand? What major changes do you personally expect to see, or what would you like to see this country do in the foreseeable future vis-a-vis the rest of Europe and indeed the world?
I think the main problem confronting this country now is that we have had the last 50 years a slow build-up into what is effectively a welfare state. From the cradle to the grave, one could take the example of Sweden, which had the same system till fairly recently, and I think Switzerland is heading the same way as Sweden is, in the sense that we can't afford it anymore. In other words, cuts will have to be made to the welfare state, back to perhaps just a social state. And if, for instance, there is no more bonus in the Swiss system, financial bonus, then really one could ask, what's the point in staying outside the EU? I think if one looks at history, if 90% of Europe is a member of the EU, in the midterm, Switzerland will have to join.
You can't beat them, join them.
To have to join them on the best possible terms, yes.
And then the words of so many, perhaps I would add this editorial comment, forward-looking politicians we've heard in the last decade or so, saying we have to get in on the ground floor of the European Union, because if we don't, we'll have nothing more to say. And maybe some of the people who say Switzerland has more to teach the EU than to learn from it, that aspect will be lost if we don't act soon. Do you see it that way too?
I think basically one of the reasons why Switzerland isn't a member of the EU is because Switzerland, and this is not my thought, it was actually a political professor who outlined this, Switzerland is basically a mini EU within itself. Mm-hmm. It is various ethnic groups, it's various religious groups, it's various national groups, all united under nationhood, who say we are more or less successful, therefore why should we join a larger body which is still trying to do this?
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yes, I think that is probably the view of most Swiss, yes.
Peter Holler, 15 years, the parliamentary correspondent for the International Swiss Radio. For many, many years, 34 years, Pete, my friend and colleague and former colleague at the International Radio, thank you so much for giving us your opinions and insights into what makes Switzerland tick.
Switzerland is not a particularly cheap European destination, and one of the first places the visitor notices that fact is when looking for a hotel. Now, I'm not denying that there are some real bargains here, nor am I saying that Switzerland is always expensive, especially if you consider the high quality of Swiss hotels. But for the average person, it's not always easy to find a hotel bargain, due to the sheer number of Swiss hostelries around. With this in mind, the Swiss national tourism advocate, Switzerland Tourism, has launched an open-ended promotion called Affordable Hotels. The main feature is a substantial list of establishments that guarantee fixed prices regardless of season. Participating hotels range from 2 to 4 stars, and the list is available as a printed brochure or via the Internet. Basically, there are 3 price categories being offered: 50, 65, and 80 Swiss francs per person per night based on double occupancy. That's about 40, 50, and 60 US dollars respectively. As everywhere in Switzerland, breakfast is included. With the exception of a possible tourism tax, a small local surcharge to aid the tourism infrastructure, there are no hidden charges or fees. These prices are bottom line. You may well ask, though, why do I have to pay per person and not by the room? That's a good question. Frankly, there's no good answer, except to say that it's simply a long tradition in Europe, and the other countries do it too. In my opinion, it's a customer-unfriendly system that should be done away with. But as long as hoteliers believe that it brings in more revenue than a flat rate for the room, we'll be stuck with it. Be that as it may, Affordable Hotels is an offer worth looking into. For more information, visit Switzerland Tourism's website at www.myswitzerland.com, and My Switzerland is written together. For Switzerland in Sound, this is Bob Zanotti.
If you want more information about Switzerland in Sound, check them out online at www.switzerlandinsound.com.
Hi, this is Bob Zanotti. Do you miss Swiss Radio International? If so, I invite you to visit my website, SwitzerlandInSound.com. Colorful and informative radio features about Switzerland, its destinations, interesting people, politics, culture, and even the two Bobs, SwitzerlandInSound.com, where English language radio from Switzerland lives on.